Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
Welcome to Secure in Mind, the podcast hosted by Nick Kelly and Alessandro Longo, where we discuss the ins and outs of technology, cybersecurity, privacy, ethics, artificial intelligence, and a whole bunch of other very exciting topics. This podcast is hosted on the Cybersecurity 360 platform. It's also assisted in production by iZoon Technology Consulting. So thank you very much to them. And just as a heads up to the listeners, I am recording in the midst of an office building and fingers crossed there won't be any nefarious activity outside the doors with some of my colleagues. So without any further ado, we have a very special guest today. His name is Martijn van der Beek. I will let him fill you in on what he does, who he is, and what his background is. Like always on this podcast, we like to explore the human story, which adds, I think, a fair bit of relevance to the everyday person who's trying to get their head around some of the things that they see in the news about cybercrime, etc. So, welcome, Martijn.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. How's the weather in Holland today? Sunny or?
It's quite okay. It's still okay till tomorrow. Then it's going to be a lot worse. But it's still nice weather. Nice barbecue weather.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. Sadly, it's not the weekend. Look, thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about this conversation because you've got an amazingly rich background and ready to get stuck into it. So I guess first things first, as with all the guests that I get on here, I'm really interested to understand what got you in and what got you interested in the work that you do. So give us a bit of a chronology about your background, et cetera.
Thank you, Nicholas. I started at the police academy as an officer training course. And after that course, I went into the Amsterdam police force, and I was placed in a management development program in which we had to switch every half a year to a different department. And I quickly realized that I wanted to work in the investigations department. And at the end of the program, the chief of police would decide where you're going to land. And they made some mistakes in the past by setting people in departments that they really didn't want to go to. So I was very curious where they want to send me. And they wanted to send, and they didn't want to tell me where I was being sent to. So I decided to apply for a position in a different police force. I became head of a war crimes unit. And I spent there 3 years investigating terrible crimes all over the world. And at that time, the Dutch police was confronted with the cybercrime issues. They had to find an answer and set up a specialist team. At that time, there still were no specialist teams working on cybercrime. And many of my colleagues I was begin 30s. And my colleagues all were 40 years or 50 years, and they were all working organized crime. And I didn't want to work on young adolescents as they saw them committing crimes from their bedrooms at their parents' house. So they want to do serious organized crimes, drugs, terrorism, etc. These kind of things. So they tried to find someone who was eager and interesting to build up the new cyber units. And for me, this was an opportunity. So I immediately said, yes, this sounds interesting. And cyber is an international thing. And I just learned a lot about working international or cross borders in very difficult circumstances. Mm. I was always interested in computers. So this sounded to me like an excellent opportunity to do something totally different.
And when was this? When was sort of...
This was 2006. It was... halfway 2006, I started in setting up the project of building the National High-Tech Crime Unit. And we started it January 1st, 2007.
So we're talking 12 years ago. And how technologically proficient were you? Or was that a prerequisite? Or you needed to hire some people who were stronger forensic investigators on computers? Or how did the construction of the team go?
You know, we decided to go for people with a very strong technical background who wanted to do something in investigations. Everybody was talking about do something about cybercrime. We're setting up this initiative, so this was the opportunity for people from the private sector to come and work with the police and investigate cybercrime. And on the other hand, we wanted to have a detective with experience in investigation and interesting in technique. And combining these both worlds, this was our strategy. And it still works still today. So this unit is still operational and for about 2 years ago, there has been an investigation in the Netherlands. How is the state of the investigations Netherlands-wide? And one of the conclusions were that the team high-tech crime unit, was one of the best institutions still working in investigation. So I think we did a pretty good job setting this up.
Yeah, it sounds like a very good legacy. It's interesting that you mentioned the people that you're hiring are out of the private sector. Fast forward to nowadays, how do you know how your unit, because you're not working there anymore, and we'll get to that in the podcast, but do you know whether there is a deficiency in talent or a difficulty in finding the right talent nowadays? Because I know that that's a general concern in many countries, that they just don't have the pipeline of people who are able to take up positions in those types of units.
Working at a unit as a national high-tech crime unit is always interesting for people. So it has a pull factor of it's interesting work.
Yeah.
And it's the only place you can do it in the Netherlands on that level. So this is a pull factor, but they're also very, the sector, the cybersecurity industry is also matured. And there's a lot of companies who want to hire people with the experience from the high-tech crime unit. So development and getting new personnel is always important, but not really, I think, an issue. Okay. It is something that you need to work on all the time and invest in new people and train new people. But that's part of your life cycle. Yeah. I saw an interview yesterday with a very experienced FBI investigator also moving to the private sector. This happens. So, yeah, this part of your life cycle, I would say.
Okay, and with reference to having a conversation with the former FBI person that you did, well, during the interview, I would love to sort of look at the sort of cross-border collaboration amongst different federal agencies. But before we do that, give us a sense, because again, the purpose of this podcast is to bring some of the, you know, incredible work that people in law enforcement do, that people in all areas, both law enforcement, activism, all these areas that people on the street may not be familiar with, and with real life examples so that we can walk them through, say, one or two stories so they understand why these, you know, why your functions exist and why it's so important that they continue to exist and thrive. Can you give me an example, obviously omitting any details, of one or two of the things that you were working on during the time there that might be, I guess, raw examples of what you're trying to fight?
If you look at it from a strategic point of view, at that time in 2007, we saw ourselves as we are the countries where very digitalized, we are rich Western countries. We're the countries that are targeted by cyber criminals. And the cyber criminals at that time, we saw the biggest threat coming from Russia, coming from former Soviet Union countries.
Yep.
Because they had a very highly developed universities and a very young population and not always enough employment. So, and this was a form of crime that you could commit doing for exactly from your bedroom with a laptop. And so from a strategic point, we saw ourselves as victims. We saw ourselves as countries where the crime would go through. They would use our infrastructure for committing crime. But the perpetrators would originate from Russia and from other former Soviet republics. And so we decided we had to set up this cooperation with these countries, the host countries where the perpetrators would originate from. So we just thought about we had to set up this cooperation. And at that time, there was an invitation for a conference of heads of security services and intelligence organizations in Russia. It was hosted by the FSB, the successor of KGB. And we thought about this is an opportunity for us because we want to go there, meet these people, and try to set up this cooperation. Because if we can do this investigation together with them, we can be effective because we can investigate what we want. But if we can never can get someone facing court and having to I'm searching for the word in English. If we can't bring to court, then yeah, our investigations are not worth so much.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. So we set us up. We went there. And I gave a presentation over there, and I talked about my very positive experiences in working with the Russians. At that time, we were not working with the Russians at all. But the fact that we were naming them so positively, and I was saying some nice words about my expectations for the future, that this cooperation did not exist at that time, but would bring so much good for both countries.
Yeah.
And I had to link it up to the subject of this conference, because it was a conference about terrorism where I was talking about cybercrime. And I made a link by setting up examples or naming examples of a terrorist organization that were financing them themselves at that time through cybercrime.
Yeah.
So I could link this stuff up, and I was able to start this cooperation, because at that time the Russians were really surprised by my positive words, because everybody was talking about we have to cooperate more and share more information. I said something like, but the Russians are already doing it, and we are really having good results, and this is really the example for the future. And as of that time, we were able to work with them.
Mm.
They were opening up. We were working together. We were able to joint pick targets, say these organizations are very dangerous organizations. Let's focus on these subjects and let's investigate them. We were able to wiretap and to gather evidence of data traffic going through our networks in the Netherlands.
Mm.
The Russians were able to investigate the subjects because they were working from their soil, so they were have other opportunities to investigate. And the Americans, they was also involved. They were able to use their opportunities on infiltration and setting up how do you say that in English? Searching for the words. Set up covert identities in which they were able to set up joint operations with the criminals and gather evidence from that perspective.
Mm.
So if you join these three perspectives together, this was very effective. And until today, we're able to cooperate in this way. It's become a bit more difficult due to the political changed environment or changed investigation into MH17, but also the situation in Ukraine.
Mm.
But still, there is still a cooperation on an investigations level, and this is unique. That this cooperation still exists.
Yeah.
And that is also a nice example of what country you take, but law enforcement officers always want to do the same thing. They always want to catch the criminal. That's their job. That's their focus. And they're not very much political. And every country has its own boundaries and its own law. But in general, theft is theft. And whether you do it digital or in a different way, it is still punishable by law. So, and most of the stuff that we're talking about, cybercrime, is all about money, making money, getting other people's money, and do it through cybercrime.
And this is where when you and I spoke prior to this recording, you know, I was expressing how interested I was in expanding on this topic, because, you know, people see BBC and people see CNN, and it really skews the public perception on country. And it's not just Russia, it's many, many, many countries that are tarred with just this very, very broad strokes brush, purely politics. And yet the fundamentals are that, you know, I don't know what the percentages are, but 85 to 90% of people just want to get by and don't want to steal anyone else's money and just want to, you know, live a nice, healthy life and most law enforcement individuals around the world are thinking the same thing: catch bad guys, bring down terrorists, keep people safe. You know, inter-country collaboration does work all the time and exists. And yet you don't hear about this in the mainstream media, of course. The fact that Holland, FBI and FSB work together actively on taking down really, really significant cyber criminals or terrorists. It's sadly underreported, and I think that's it's a really valuable thing that has been set up. That still exists today, and it's expanded, as you mentioned. You know, obviously with some of the politics involved, but are there other countries involved? Is Australia involved? Is Italy involved? Is it a multi collaboration?
It depends on the investigation, which country is involved. But in general, you could say that the law enforcement cooperation in cyber has only matured. So. I think the answer to your question is yes, but it depends on the kind of investigation which parties are have an interest and therefore would be or more or less involved.
Yeah.
And in general, you see that countries are maturing. At the time we started working on cybercrime, the FSB was the only organization in Russia that was really able to take down cybercrime in a professional way. At this moment, there are other organizations active as well. So the cooperation has expanded to these organizations as well. Because, it is still a bit difficult working with the police and with the FSB. It's a different kind of beast. So, but on the other hand, if you look at from the perspective, if you compare FSB and FBI, they have the same objectives.
Yeah.
But the FBI has been promoted through all the Hollywood films as being a good guy, being doing the right stuff. But in the end, they're also an investigations organization next to an intelligence organization. Yeah. And the intelligence organization is working for Uncle Sam and for nobody else.
Yeah.
And the same goes for the Russians. But with the Russians, we see it from a different perspective because we have some difficulties with the way they commit their political actions are being executed, the way they behave at the moment.
And again, I think you're right. It just highlights the point that the public perception is skewed depending on some of the media attention that you're looking at, or say even some of the movies that are made. Out of interest, what has been your perception on the rule of law and the ability to prosecute from identity of target right through to persecution and sentencing? Do you see that is still a highly effective mechanism in Russia? Do you see some holes? Or it's a general question, I know, but
it's difficult for me to answer how it is today because I have been out of this specific investigations branch as of 2012. Mm. I'm working now in the private sector, so how it is today, it's difficult to say. But in general, the feedback that we got that based on the investigations we did together, evidence was gathered and people were brought to trial, but you don't follow these trials in Russia. It's difficult to understand because the feedback that you get is not always that much. Because based on the political situation at the time, I remember a time when Jaap Schaffer was head I don't know if it was Jaap Schaffer, but the Dutchman was Secretary General of NATO.
Yep.
And NATO said something about Russia. And at that time, the Russians were given the instruction, don't talk to the Dutch anymore because Jaap Schaffer, a Dutchman, said this and this. Russia is very black and white in that. So we only learned through the Ukrainians that they did something with our evidence. So the feedback was not always the way it would be if we were working with a Western country, but we learned that they did stuff with our evidence, and they were able to crack down on cyber criminals, and they do it the Russian style, so according to their criminal code and their procedures, which differ from ours.
Mm.
And then you see sometimes you work with intelligence organization that investigated targets might even be asked to work for the government and contribute in a more positive way, maybe between brackets, but that's the way it works. But in the end, they didn't attack us anymore. They didn't commit cybercrime anymore. Maybe not anymore cybercrime focused on getting money from Western countries, but maybe other acts that we would consider being cybercrime, depending on who they're working for now.
Mm.
But this is the way it works. So according to our system, they would go to court and they would be either they would be convicted and getting a sentence, or be accused of their what's the word for it in English? They would be set free. But in Russia, there's a third option as well: work for the government.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And I mean, it's such a big initiative that you were able to wander in there at the conference and tie in terrorism, cybercrime, and get the FSB on side. That was you who really forged through that relationship. That's really impressive stuff. Okay, with reference to cyber and terrorism, can you give us, I guess, an example of how those two fit together? Because I think, again, many listeners would try and they'd scratch their head and think, well, terrorism is, the physical, it's explosives, etc. How does cyber tie in with that? Is it something to do with money laundering? I'm sort of prompting you here, but give us a sense. I don't know if there's an example which you can very loosely play on, or if not, then just give us a broad sense of how the two fit together.
Yeah, I haven't been involved in terrorism for a long time, so it is a bit from my... But if you look at it from, I see cybercrime as a digital form of crimes that always have been there. There's money somewhere, you want to get it. Either it's physical money, it's digital money, it's data that are valuable for organization. By stealing it, you could sell it to someone else, or etc. So cybercrime for me is just an evolved way of the old crimes.
Yeah.
So terrorism, for me, cybercrime is a means for if you look from terrorism, if you want to commit terrorism, you can do it the old way in blowing stuff up, killing people, threatening people, but you could also destroy economies, you could destroy infrastructure, yep, etc. But it's also a way of acquiring money for your organization. The example I used in Russia was about an extremist group in the Philippines who used cybercrime for financing their operations. So, yeah, they're interlinked, and depending on what suits an organization, they can either use it for financing their businesses or committing terrorist acts. I can imagine that if you really want to destroy a country, want to hit something, you don't need to blow it up anymore. You could do other stuff as well. They are quite as impactful as an explosion or something else.
Yeah. Okay, so moving forward in your background, well, I guess up to nowadays, because you've been at Hoffman for the last, four odd years, what do you do with all that wealth of experience now? Nowadays? Do you work with private sector? Give us a rundown of what you do on a day-to-day basis.
My company is experienced in fraud investigations, and we set up an initiative in working without the government and being able to work with civil law. So we do the investigation, our attorney's office that we're working with does the procedures through criminal or through a civil law, and we have a company that is specialized in tracking assets and seizing them. So by investigating ourselves, seizing assets and following procedures through civil courts, we're able to investigate fraud with a minimal need of government involvement. So the private sector is able to clean up sometimes their own mess, because organizations have fraud cases, but they're always committed in a context. So people are committing these frauds because it's possible, because organizations don't always pay attention, don't always give the right examples to their people, are not always that inclusive with their employees, so people feel alienated and are not so much involved anymore. And we follow these investigations up with a team of psychologists, and they look at the reasons why people committed crime, and most of the time you do that with security experts, etc. But we decided to do it differently and look at the human factor in fraud. And we investigate that with psychologists, and based on their findings, we're able to give very concrete and feedback to companies what they can change to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
And this point, I would really want to expand on. This is a fascinating thing, which is it's changing that mindset, isn't it? It's changing it from, okay, it's just a tech problem, to no, there is a human element involved, but let's address that properly and professionally, utilizing psychologists. Can you expand on that a bit more about what the process is, what the psychologist recommendation, or what how they work in with it?
What we do, we go to companies, and you could do it either from an integrity point of view. For example, in an organization that is, or part of the organization that is involved in contract management and this kind of stuff. We had, for example, a large case in which kickback fees were given to the people who were involved in buying the stuff for the organizations, and not in a proper way. And we decided to go and investigate why these people were doing this. So we said there are all kinds of rules and procedures, and they have not been followed in this case. And you want to know why are they not following these rules and procedures? And everybody knows these rules and procedures, but why are they not doing it? So we said we want to investigate the gap between what's being expected from people and what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you can only investigate that by setting up target groups. For example, all people with the same role in an organization, they are part of one target group. The management is another one. And we set up interviews with them, with our group of psychologists. And it's different talking to a police officer or an ex-police officer or a cybersecurity expert than talking to a psychologist. It's a different feeling. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
And we're working with anonymously. People can talk to us and give their opinions, and they're not being reported with this guy's saying that, this guy's saying that. No, it's about the general feedback that we get from these target groups. What is the finding that's been useful for the whole of organization? And being able to give that back to the organization has been very valuable for many of our customers.
And do you do that on a case-by-case basis, or are you in the process of, I guess, building a one-size-fits-all kind of product that you can then sell off to different companies and add consulting on top of that? Or how are you packaging that?
Yeah, we have a system. We call that the Hoffman 3x3 model. And it's based on a psychologist theory. And we're using that as a framework. And we are using it to advise organizations on how to work with, for example, if you look at from a cyber perspective, people are always talking about we need to have more awareness. People need to be aware about what the risks are from cyber are. Yeah, everybody knows that clicking on all kinds of links is dangerous, but people are still doing it. We all know that we are driving our car. We don't have to app. If we app in a car, the risk for a car crash is huge, but we're still doing it. So, and we know it's dangerous. So it's not about knowing that it's dangerous. It's something else. Now that something else needs to be explored. So I'm always saying, if you have a problem, you need to take more time for the analysis, what the underlying problem is. If you really understand that, then you can take the right measures.
So to use the analogy of the car, I mean, it's a really valid point that you're saying we know it's dangerous, but we still do it anyway. People know that texting on their phone is dangerous whilst driving, but they still do it anyway, and people still die. People know that drink driving is a very, very dangerous thing, and speeding, and yet they still do it. And with all the safety protections that we have, the seatbelts, the airbags, the reinforced steel, the crumple zones, we still do it. So really interested, what do the psychologists say, and can we fix this problem, or is it more about containment or a mixture?
Sometimes it's a mixture of messages of things. For example, we had an investigation where people didn't wear their badges with their names on it and their company cards saying that they're working there. And by investigation, what was the problem? The problem was they didn't like the keycords. They just didn't like it.
Yeah.
So the example was like, give the people the opportunity to change their key, to choose their own key cord or whatever you want to do. You want them to wear the badge. The key cord is not important. And sometimes it's a simple technical solution once you understand what it's like. For example, they don't want to wear their badge, but one of our recommendations was, if you go to the restaurant, you need to have your card to pay for the food. So if you enforce that, then people are wearing their badges because it has a function. So by understanding why they're not doing it, you can give concrete advice for changing the behavior.
Okay. And then after the company receives the advice, it's the implementation. Is it a mixture again of carrot and stick? So for example, you're penalized in this, or there's an internal, you know, pretend phishing campaign to, you know, educate people on clicking links or not, which is they click in a link. It's a benign link, but it flashes up and it says, you know, please make sure that you check this link. What's the implementation phase after you've given the advice?
It depends on what the company wants, but what we like to do is setting up a meeting with the people who are responsible for these measures to be taken and involve them in setting up solutions. So we can help them in addressing why the people are not doing it. But as of once they know what the problem is, it's for them to design the solution. We can help them. And by setting up these meetings in order to pressure cook and think of solution that can work, that they thought about themselves instead of us saying, you need to do this and this. No, we help you in analyzing and defining the problem. Mm. And once we know that, it's for the company to set up something that's working for them.
Yeah.
So there is we cannot always really design all solutions because it has to fit in their environment. So it's very much important that you have people on board and tailor making their own solutions.
Excellent. We're marching on in time. It's been a really interesting discussion. And I guess just to move to the last point, based on, you know, the wealth of experience that you've had and also what you're doing currently, are there any sort of tips that you would give, you know, the everyday person in a company or at their private home, just to take care on online? What kind of examples would you use in that respect? Anything just so that, you know, the listeners can walk away with something that they can implement that makes sense?
My tip would be enforce difficult passwords, but do not enforce people to change them too often. And once you want to make a difficult password, think about a sentence. Just a sentence is something you can remember. Mm-hmm. And use the first words of this sentence. And okay. And that is a word that's not in a dictionary. You cannot find it. And it's very strong and easy to remember. And you make it easy for your people in your company to remember this password if you don't focus them to change it too much.
Good tips. When I spoke to J. Michael Daniel, one of the previous guests, we both agreed that a password manager, you know, and a password manager is not going to, you know, it's going to be redundant if you're based with a nation state adversary. But let's face it, 99.999% of people aren't. So to remember all those passwords, have a very strong password on your password manager, and then the rest, it takes care of itself. So good advice. Look, we've come to the end. Thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating, and big credit to you for setting up such a strong functioning cross collaboration federal policing information sharing unit, and not just information sharing, but enacting unit that can identify cyber criminals and terrorists and doesn't get weighed down by the politics. Well, not as much. So, I mean, that's really good stuff. It's very, very impressive. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much for asking me for this podcast.
My absolute pleasure. I'll look forward to, last question. When are you going to visit Italy?
I just went there for my holiday, so probably next year.
Okay. I missed you. I was down in Australia. So look, I'll try and pop up to Holland. I used to be in Hollandspoor, in The Hague for back when I was younger. So anyway, I will catch you somewhere around the world, Martin. Thank you so much for your time again. And it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.